Good evening, church. How are we all doing? All right, let's continue to study God's Word. We're going to head over to Numbers, chapter 24. Messianic prophecy study. Got to spend a few weeks in Genesis. That was cool. That was fun. Wrapped up chapter 49 last week, that the scepter would not depart from Judah. Kings have scepters, and would let us know that the scepter would stay with Judah. Kings would come from the tribe of Judah until Shiloh came. And Shiloh is the rest bringer, the peaceful one, and we looked at some New Testament verses clearly, and even in Isaiah that communicate that Jesus was the one who brings ultimate rest, and that where true peace lies, and He's extended that peace to us through His gospel and His Spirit. So that was cool. So, just again as we look back to Genesis, we just see a broad description of the coming one, and then almost as a filter. Narrowing down of more specifics regarding the Messiah. And so today is cool one here in Numbers 24. Maybe a little more of an emphasis on timing of the Messiah. So I guess before we jump in, we ought to spend just a couple minutes discussing kind of some context here. So we've got Balak, king of Moab, and Balak's interested in defeating his enemies, so he hires the prophet Balaam to curse them. And initially, Balaam says, no thanks. But they press him hard, They keep upping the ante. They keep upping that price. And finally the Lord gives Balaam the okay. Go ahead. Not to curse the people, but to prophesy for King Balak. And so he goes, but the Lord tells him, but you got to say exactly what I tell you. And to that, Balaam does a good job. And along the way, as he instead doesn't curse Israel, but then blesses them, Balak gets upset, and they go back and forth a number of times. And then we commonly remember along the way, he finds himself talking to a donkey. And so what we're going to look at here in Numbers 24 is his final discourse. If you look in verse 15, is his final discourse that he picks up. As Balak would like him to curse Israel. And in this prophecy, we find a prophecy of the Messiah and some prophetic language regarding some events that were going to happen in the future. So why I say this prophecy is going to be more of a have messianic tones in the timing in which the Messiah would come. That's kind of the context surrounding this, the final discourse that Balaam takes up. Balaam's story doesn't end there, but I think preached a message on it, or maybe when we went through 2 Peter, we covered it a few months ago. So Numbers 24, we'll start in verse 15. He took up his discourse and said, "The oracle of Balaam the son of Beor, and the oracle of the man who eyes open, the oracle of him who hears the words of God, and knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty falling down, yet having his eyes uncovered. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come forth from Jacob, a scepter shall rise from Israel, and shall crush through the forehead of Moab, and tear down all of the sons of Sheth. Edom shall be a possession. Seir, its enemies, also will be a possession, while Israel performs valiantly. One from Jacob shall have dominion, and will destroy the remnant from the city." And he looked at Amalek and took up his discourse and said, "Amalek was the first of the nations, but his end shall be destruction." And he looked at the Kenite and took up his discourse and said, "Your dwelling place is enduring, and your nest is set in the cliff. Nevertheless, Cain will be consumed. And how long will Asher keep you captive?" Then he took up his discourse and said, "Alas, who can live except God has ordained it? But ships have come from the coast of Kittim, and they shall afflict Asher and will afflict Eber. So they will also come to destruction." Then Balaam arose and departed and returned to his place, and Balak also went his way. I got a lot to unpackage here. So he starts his discourse, and he says in verse 17, "I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. Someone's coming." Pretty cool. "A star shall come forth from Jacob." So, as we read this, "a star shall come forth from Jacob." Not super convinced. This is referring to the star that the men from the east followed. You read through that, and I think when you hear about a star shall come, and we understand this has messianic tones, then our brains just instantly connect to the New Testament when there was a star that rested over the place where Mary and the child were, and that's how the men from the east would be able to find the Messiah. Now, I'm thinking out loud here, but if you would really think that the Gospel of Matthew would cover this, okay? Now, we understand that the Gospel of Matthew was written primarily to a Jewish audience. Okay? And if you're not convinced, just read Matthew chapter 1. Okay? An entire lineage that begins from Abraham all the way to Jesus to show that Jesus is the rightful heir of these promises. That he has the Jewish lineage to back it up. So, again, just thinking out loud for a moment, if this right here, from Numbers, from Balaam, says a star shall come forth from Jacob, is fulfilled through a star resting over the house where Mary and the child lay, you would think Matthew would cover that. Okay, if you consider the New Testament for a moment, the writer of Hebrews, again, written to Hebrews, has some of the most Old Testament tie-ins into its letter. Now, Jared has been making this point really well as we go through Paul's missionary journeys. Paul shows up into a place that has a Jewish population and a synagogue. He may begin with the law, with Moses. He may begin with faith in Abraham. He shows up into a region primarily dwelt with Gentiles, and he starts working on the one true God and not the gods of Zeus or Hermes or whatnot. So when you have a letter like Hebrews that's written to the Hebrew people and you're trying to show the Hebrew people that the old system is being replaced with a new, you're going to use the old system to show them that. I mean, you take Romans, for example. Paul's really working on the idea that righteousness was credited to Abraham prior to his circumcision. Now, that's a really good point for the Jew who's having a hard time accepting the Gentile Christian in his uncircumcision. But the point is Paul uses the law, uses the Old Testament to communicate to the Jew so that the Jew would appreciate and understand these lessons. So, New Testament Hebrews, written to the Hebrew people, has some of the most Old Testament references in tie-ins. And Matthew's intended audience was Hebrew, to which he makes many Old Testament references. Many, many. There's only a couple New Testament letters. What I'm trying to say is there's only a few couple New Testament letters that have more Old Testament tie-ins than the Gospel of Matthew. So as Matthew's laying this out and showing Jesus' messiahship, if this star that came forth from Jacob is somehow fulfilled in a star over the house, you would think Matthew would include that. The other reason why I hold this position is the star doesn't come from Jacob, it settles over Bethlehem. Does that make sense? The star that the men from the east come and follow doesn't come forth from Jacob. Right? It settles over Jacob. it specifically settles over Bethlehem. Where did the star come from? Well, okay, you know, the sky. All right? What's really being, you know, so when I think of the star here, the Messiah shall come forth from Jacob. Okay? Does I think context also gives that impression. So if we look at verse 17, I see him. I behold him. And a star shall come forth from Jacob. And I think that language lines up better with what we've been looking at through Genesis, where God's going to dwell among Shem, and that the scepter is going to be with Judah, and that, you know, Jesus would come from the seed of woman and come from the seeds of God. He would be God among the tents. And so we see that he shall come forth from Jacob. The star shall come forth from Jacob. Just some thoughts here. And then I'll take us to Revelation 22, just to kind of cement why I hold this position, that the star is referring to the Messiah, the star is referring to Jesus, and maybe not necessarily a connection to that star that that Matthew records for us. But in Revelation 22, we'll just grab verse 16. I, Jesus, have sent my angel to testify to you these things for the churches. I am the root and the descendant of David, the bright morning star. Okay. So I think that lines up scripturally with the New Testament better, that the star in Numbers 24:17 is referring to Jesus and maybe not that star that set over the house where Mary and the child lay. So just wanted to cover that real quick as we got started here. Any comments on that? Okay. Got a couple. We'll start in the back here with Roger.
I guess it's more of a question that I got in my mind about, you said that, read that verse about the morning star, and then maybe clarify for me, like, a confusion that I've had, because the devil's also referred to as a morning star.
That's what Lucifer means.
Yeah. So, but isn't Jesus referred to as a morning star at times?
So we just read that in Revelation 22.
Yeah, so what?
I would say to reconcile both of those, Paul writes to the Corinthians and reminds us that Satan likes to disguise himself as an angel of light.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. And Rain?
Yeah, just regarding Peter in 2 Peter, would this have a tie-in to... So we have the prophetic word made more sure, to which you'll do attention to. Pay attention to as a lamp shining in a dark place until the day dawns and the morning star rises in your hearts. I know that's a step past, but ultimately that's the more complete goal, was the indwelling presence of Christ in you.
So if Christ in you is the morning star, then the star again is Christ. Yes, that ties in.
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Just.
Yep, absolutely. Any other comments? Jared.
It's a nuance, but the verse also says bright morning star. So there's a difference there, and very specific, you know, the Holy Spirit's very specific about the words that he chooses. So that's one of the ways that I would bolster that argument.
Yeah, sure. You know, some just little things to think about. It's like, okay, this is kind of a big deal. Matthew might have covered it, and he doesn't. And then just when we understand the way the New Testament, I'm glad Rain grabbed 2 Peter there, yeah, just kind of shows. So again, just to kind of follow the theme and the context here, I see him, I behold him, but it's not now and it's not here or near. So whoever he is, he's coming, and that he will come forth from Jacob. And again, I mean, that language as we've been going through Genesis has been very clear. This Messiah will come and he will come from Israel. The next line here in verse 17, he says, a scepter shall rise from Israel. We covered scepter last week. Just maybe notice some little intricate differences. The scepter shall not depart from Judah until the peaceful one comes. And then he's going to take hold of that scepter, right? But he's the king, and he's the peace bringer king. Here, he will be king because he will have that scepter, but he will also be a conquering king. So was the only thing that I noticed a little different here in the language, because when we go on, he will crush through Moab and tear down the sons of Sheth. So as we consider, I mean, we kind of understand the language of a scepter shall rise from Israel. We've covered that last week. Just notice here that this is a conquering king. And the king that we saw in Genesis 49 was the peaceful one and the rest bringer. And again, the rest comes from the conquering. Right? It's like you enter into his rest, the writer of Hebrews says, if you remain faithful. So the rest comes from the conquering. I didn't really intend on covering a whole lot on that. I'm going to keep moving here. If you got something, you just feel free to raise your hand. So he goes on and says, and shall crush through the forehead of Moab. And oh boy, this has got to be good for Balak, right? And tear down all the sons of Sheth. So the literal there on Sheth is the sons of tumult. Okay? So you can think of like tumultuous, right? Like they probably don't have it so good. Little unclear here as to who Sheth is. Could be an alternate. Again, this is as near as I can tell. Could be a prominent Moabite. If we follow this along here, the scepter is going to come. He's going to crush through Moab and tear down the sons of Sheth. So as he's conquering Moab, then specifically directed towards a tribe and ahead of that tribe. It's a pretty common understanding. Could also be a reference to Seth. Could be a reference to Seth. And again, without a whole lot of other Old Testament references to this word, I personally think it's kind of hard to nail down. What I do think we can nail down is when we keep it in the context of the verse here, scepter's going to come, Moab's going to be crushed, and Sheth is going to go along with him. And, you know, the Messiah king isn't going to crush anybody who didn't deserve it. So I kind of wonder if maybe this is more of a reference to a prominent Moabite. But we'll see. The Moabites kind of become a problem here down the road. Any thoughts on that? Or any comments on the verse right before that, the line before that? Yeah.
I guess the way that I've kind of looked at this in the past, when you think about who Sheth could be, which, you know, would be, I think it may be a reference to Seth, like you said.
Yeah.
If you think about the context of these verses, he says, a scepter shall rise from Israel. And what does a scepter mean? What does it signify? It means power. It means ruler, right? And he's going to crush through the forehead of Moab and tear down all the sons of Sheth or Seth, which would be the sons of Adam, which would be I kind of look at it like the kingdoms of the world. Mm-hmm. Like all those things are going to be wiped out, and the only thing that's going to remain is he who holds the scepter. Mm-hmm.
And so, and I definitely agree with that. You know, so I didn't spend a whole lot of time trying to narrow down, is this a reference to, you know, or is this the head of Moab? Because the one thing that is clear in this is that God has victory over his opposition. If we draw anything from the rest of this here other than a pretty cool little timeline until the Messiah would come, it's that God has victory over his opposition. And so, yeah, absolutely. That theme does carry through very loud through the rest of these verses. You know, that whoever the originator is, a head of a clan of the Moabites, or is it a representative of the sons of Adam, at the end of the day, it's those who oppose God will receive their just condemnation at the hands of the judging and conquering king. Okay, so then we go on here, and verse 18, Edom shall be a possession. Seir, its enemies, will also be a possession, while Israel performs valiantly. Same theme here, right? Edom's going down, Seir's going down, Israel's going up. But what I want us to start to notice here is, let's cover our definitions, let's cover our terms, and then let's notice the timeline. Because what we're going to see here is, I just love how this starts. I see him. And then he goes into which kingdoms are going to fall. And there's an order. And there's a timeline. And that's what I want us to see. So let's cover our definitions here. Edom shall be a possession. Seir, its enemies, will also be a possession. Seir, a reference to the region or to the people of Edom. So I would kind of like Ephraim, Israel, same thing. Israel, Jacob, same thing, right? I would think Edom, Seir, same thing. If we go back to Genesis chapter 32, well, Jacob's about to meet an angel. But if we look in verse 3, Genesis 32, 3, Jacob sent messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. Okay. So when we read that in Numbers, it's referring to a land, which is also the same reference to a people. Okay? Real quick, the brother's name is Esau. Anyone, and so the land is also known as the land of Seir. Any idea why it's called the country of Edom? We've heard of the Edomites. Where'd they come from? Take us back to chapter 25. And then I think 32 will make sense why these three terms, Seir, Esau, and Edom, are all being used interchangeably. 25 verse 30. Many of us understand the context here. Esau says to Jacob, "Please let me have a swallow of that red stuff there, for I am famished." Therefore, his name was called Edom, which literally is going to come through as red. Okay. So the Edomites are the descendants of Esau, all right? Again, and the prophecy is that they will decrease while Israel increases. Edom will become a possession. Seir and its enemies will also be a possession. Kind of back to Jared's comment earlier. Again, we see God in the end will triumph over all of his enemies, anyone who is against him or his people. Okay, his nation came from Jacob and not Esau, and so if they don't get on board, then and they are in opposition to God and His people, then they will decrease while God's people increase. Okay, we're going to keep moving here. Comment.
In reference to possession, there that's actually promised to Abraham after he was willing to offer up Isaac. As one of the promises, he said, in your seed, you know, he will possess the gates of his enemies. And that goes on, obviously, to Christ and then to the church.
Yep, yep. And so a part of that physical fulfillment is that Edom would be crushed. And then the true fulfillment is when the church has victory over Satan and Satan's placed underneath the feet of the church in Jesus Christ. Yep, great point. Okay, let's keep moving on here because we do want to get through verse 24. So in verse 19, one from Jacob shall have dominion, and he will destroy the remnant from the city. Jesus will come, judging those who do not know God and those who do not obey the gospel of Jesus Christ. Paul writes that to the Thessalonians, and none will be able to hide. So again, we see a conquering Messiah. Okay, he's going to come from Jacob. He's going to have dominion and will destroy the remnant from the city. Okay. And Israel doesn't accomplish that. Right? In fact, Israel gets pummeled by the Assyrians. If you want to extend it as far as Judah, maybe they made it into the Palestine times, and then God finished them off with the Romans in 70 AD. So this one who comes from Jacob shall have ultimate dominion that can only be truly fulfilled through Jesus Christ. Go on over to Revelation again, chapter 6 this time. Just a picture of Jesus' dominion and judgment.
Revelation
Verse 15. Then the kings of the earth and the great men and the commanders and the rich and the strong and every slave and free man hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains. And they said to the mountains and to the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the presence of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who is able to stand? It's the one who comes forth from Jacob who has ultimate dominion and authority and will destroy the remnant from the city. So that remnant, meaning that small remaining, whatever's left over, like the one who comes from Jacob, he'll have that dominion, that authority, that judgment, that power, and he's going to, so he says he's going to destroy the remnant. Like, it's one thing to come through and to, like, destroy a large metropolitan area, but then you're always going to have, like, some fragments of survivors sitting around, right? Like, they don't make it either. When the one who comes from Jacob has dominion, even the remnant meets their judgment. And so that's why that revelation is a good picture there, because when the Lamb of God comes and judges the world according to the words that he has spoken, the people who are trying to hide in the caves and behind the trees will be found out because he has ultimate power and dominion. It's a good picture of Jesus. If I should have just said that, maybe. I always think of like the short way to say it after I've said it the long way. And maybe that's that's how I got to the short way. But yeah, let's keep going here. Before we continue on, recognize, and again, recognize that no one physical king from Jacob accomplishes all of these things. Edom, Seir, Moab, and then as we continue to go on with Cain and the Kenites and Asher and Eber, like no king from Jacob, from Judah, fulfills these. You can't go into the history of the kings of Israel or the kings of Judah, right, or even Herod the Great. You can't go to any one of those guys and see that they fulfilled this. How we know it's messianic. Okay. We see God in the end will triumph over his enemies, anyone who is against him. Verse 20. And he looked at Amalek and took up his discourse and said, Amalek was the first of the nations, but his end shall be destruction. Now, and this was something that I thought was intriguing. I told myself I would ask you first. So he looks at Amalek and he switches his focus from Moab and Edom to Amalek. And he says, Amalek was the first of the nations, but his end will be destruction. Any idea what he means the Amalekites were first? Have we thought about it before? Yep. Yep, Josh.
So I think, and you tell me if this is what you were thinking. But, well, so I think that it could mean that they were one of the first nations to kind of spread out there, right? Mm-hmm. But also, if you look at what the Amalekites did to the Israelites, when the Israelites came out of Egypt, the slaves running from slavery,
yes,
and the Amalekites came out and attacked them,
yes,
from the rear and tried, yes, to kill the weak ones. Like, what kind of an attitude thinks that you're going to come out here and attack these people wandering in the wilderness, mm-hmm, and kill the weak ones? Yeah. So he was the first of the nations. He had that pride,
yep,
and his end would be destruction. So it seems like he's looking around and he's prophesying against all the nations that were currently there as Israel was coming out, and he's going to prophesy of their destruction. But you can look at those nations, and you can look at what they did and try to get back to where they were at as a people,
yep,
like spiritually, and see that if you are that type of person, that somebody else is in a bad way, mm-hmm, and you're going to go try and attack and hurt them, God will destroy that spirit. Mm-hmm. But yep, there is a certain spirit that's coming from Israel. And when that spirit comes, that spirit will have ultimate dominion.
Yep. Yeah. What you're saying. Yeah, that was the answer I was looking for. Yeah. So Amalek's first, right? In the bowling league. Well, what are they first in? Well, they were the first nation to oppose Israel as the slaves, as Josh told us, were coming out of Egypt. Let's turn on over to Exodus 17. So again, this theme, you oppose God, you oppose God's people, and he's just systematically going down, bang, 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 judgment, judgment, judgment. But what we'll see at the end is a pretty cool timeline. Exodus 17, verse 8. Then Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. And so this is where Moses said to Joshua, choose men for us to go out, fight against Amalek tomorrow. I will station myself on top of the hill. See, we remember this story. Moses goes up on top of the hill with the staff of God in his hand. And Joshua did as Moses told him, fought against Amalek. Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up on the mountain. And Israel prevailed when the staff was over his head, right? But, you know, he's there for a while and his arms get weary. So Aaron and Hur, you get the left elbow, I'll get the right elbow, and they help hold the staff over so that Israel can prevail. But that story comes from a nation who was their first opposition as they were coming out of the land of Egypt. So the Amalekites were the first to oppose them. Again, no king fulfills this. Okay, now we see that through Saul, the conquest of the Amalekites kind of starts. And they do deal them quite a blow. But remember how that story went? Samuel's like, why do I hear in the background? He's like, I told you to kill the Amalekites, and I told you to wipe out all the livestock, but Saul saved some of them so we could offer them to the Lord, right? Well, Saul didn't go through with what God told him to do to utterly destroy the Amalekites. And actually, the Amalekites aren't really finished off until the reign of King Hezekiah. I thought it'd be worth showing us this. 1 Chronicles chapter 4. Okay, do want to get through this, so if you look in verse 24, the sons of Simeon, okay, and then you kind of let your eyes glance down your pages, you can see son, son, born, son, son, born, okay? When we get to verse 39, they went to the entrance of Gedor, even to the east side of the valley to seek pasture for their flocks. They found rich and good pasture, and the land was broad and quiet and peaceful, for those who lived there formerly were Hamites. The descendants of Simeon. So these recorded by name came in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah, and attacked their tents, okay, the Hamites, and the Meunites, who were there, and destroyed them utterly to this day, and lived in their place because there was pasture for their flocks. From the sons of Simeon, 500 men went to Mount Seir, and Pelatiah, and Neriah, and Rephaim, and Uzziel, and the son of Ishi, as their leaders, and they destroyed the remnant of the Amalekites who escaped and have lived there to this day. So we see really this not coming completely fulfilled and through until the reign of King Hezekiah. So I just wanted to throw that in there. If we could turn back to Numbers 24 and keep moving. Got a few more definitions to cover here. So verse 21. I'm in the wrong chapter. Yeah, 21. Okay, and then he looked at the Kenite and took up his discourse and said, your dwelling place is enduring and your nest is set in the cliff. Now who are the Kenites? Again, I just want to cover these definitions so we know who we're talking about here. Those Kenites. The Kenites come from Jethro, Moses' father-in-law. If we go ahead here to Judges chapter 1, not only do these descendants come from Jethro, but they did spend quite a bit of time with the nation of Israel. Okay, if we look here in Judges chapter 1, verse 16, the descendants of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up from the city of Palms with the sons of Judah to the wilderness of Judah, which is in the south of Arad, and they went and lived with the people. So we see the people, the descendants of Jethro, like not necessarily like teaming up with, but geographically settling with the people of Israel, specifically Judah, in the section we read there in Judges. So when we look back at Numbers 24, this makes a lot of sense. He, in verse 21, he looks at the Kenite, takes up his discourse and says, your dwelling place is enduring. Like the Kenite had found a dwelling place amongst Israel. Because that Judges tells us that the people basically integrated into the country geographically. And your nest is set in the cliff. You know, I mean, if you were in the cliffs, you were kind of on the outskirts, kind of like in a protective type sense. Like you were just trying to lay low. Okay? Saul chases David. David goes to the caves. Right? Like, that's kind of why you would live in that region. So the Kenites come from Jethro, and they had a decent relationship with Israel. Verse 22, nevertheless, Cain will be consumed. How long will Asher keep you captive? Now, I think this is where this starts to get pretty cool. Cain can be a reference to one of two, if not both, things. Historical writings, non-biblical, okay, tell us that Cain is a reference to the Kenites. Okay, I can't find a verse in the Old Testament that makes it clear. Like that number, like that verse we read, it said the Kenites were Jethro's, like the offspring of Jethro, right? Like we can clearly make that connection. I cannot from the scriptures tell you that Cain is a reference to the Kenites. We have some other historical information that tells us that they were, that that's a reference back to them. The one thing we do know from the scripture is that Cain is the name of a Judean city. That's, Judah was where the Kenites settled. That's what we read, right? It says they went into the land of Judah, went to the city, and kept their place there. And the context is like presumably up to this day that they dwelled among the people of Israel. So as we piece this together in Numbers 24, he looks at Kenite, your dwelling place is enduring. You've survived, right? You're okay. It's in the cliffs. It's often set off to the side. But nevertheless, Cain, the Kenite, will be consumed. The city of Cain, where the Kenites dwell, will still be consumed. How long will Asher keep you captive? Okay. Now, Asher's going to be a reference to the Assyrian Empire. Okay. A rendering of that word. So as we consider this, if we have, the Kenites will meet their end at the hands of Assyria. That fits biblical history perfectly. Because it was Assyria that completely wiped out Israel and went down into the regions of Judah and Benjamin and did a lot of conquering because they had to, if you can picture a map, they had to go through Judah to get to Egypt. And Assyria made it to Egypt. Okay? In fact, the scriptures tell us that they conquered so much of Judah that they basically had the whole thing conquered and just had Jerusalem, the city alone, left and had it surrounded. Well, there's a great message in there because the king prayed to God and looked to God for help and not to the chariots or the help of the Egyptian army or to himself. And so King Hezekiah prays for relief, and then the angel comes and destroys the 185,000 Assyrian soldiers in one night. Okay, but it was the Assyrian that went through those regions and wreaked havoc and brought destruction upon these lands. So we can see we're just moving down the timeline. Boom, boom, boom. He looks at Moab, the current oppressors, dealing with them. Edom, the remnant coming in from Esau, gonna take care of them. Amalek, opposed God's people, gonna take care of them. No Israelite king did this. We see maybe the Amalekites polished off during the reign of King Hezekiah. Okay, but no king fulfills this. It's done through when God wins the battle over evil. Okay, when we're called home. So Jesus Christ is the one who fulfills this. So how long will Asher, how long will Assyria keep you captive? That's exactly what happened. The Assyrians came and took a lot of those people captive. Now Judah's able, through the salvation of the angel and King Hezekiah's prayer, remain as a remnant and go on for, you know, a few more years before Babylon finishes them off with the temple along with it. But this is exactly how we see it play out. So now we keep going. In verse 23, then he took up his discourse and said, "Alas, who can live except God has ordained it?" Good verse. Okay, life comes from God, spiritual life from Jesus Christ. "But ships shall come from the coast of Kittim, and they shall afflict Asher and will afflict Eber. So they also will come to destruction." Now, this is just so cool. Right? Now, I'm not trying to trick you, okay? But how do I want to do this? Any idea where Kittim is geographically? Okay, yes. We got someone.
I believe it would be the island of Cyprus.
Yes. Yes. So that region in there, south of Greece, west of Turkey, in the Mediterranean region. Now, but Cyprus was the island I had written down. Like, if I could just, like, give you a New Testament island that we would know, like, that's Kittim. Okay? So who came? How does Numbers say this? "Ships will come from the coast of Kittim, and they will afflict Asher and will afflict Eber." So what Asher does and Eber does is it gives us geographical markers. Okay? So if you can picture Israel on the east coast of the Mediterranean Sea, Assyria would have been a little north and east from there. Scripture tells us they just had to come down to destroy Israel. Babylon, Persia, they're a little more east. China, India. Does that make sense? So what we have here is someone coming from the west, specifically through the Mediterranean, probably hitting pieces of Greece there, into the mainland where Israel is, and then conquering Asher and Eber. Can anybody think of a king who came from the west, heading east, and destroyed not only the regions of Assyria, but went as far to take down Persia as well? Alexander the Great. And so, you know, we pick up our history books and we read about Greece, and it literally tells us that Kittim is a reference to the warpath geographically that Alexander the Great took. So what now has just happened is we have him coming, he afflicts Asher and Eber, and okay, I said all this, that gives us clues to this region geographically. Okay, the western lands of Syria and the eastern lands of Persia. So now we go through. God's past opposers, the Amalekites, going to crush them. Moab, going to play a pretty big role in opposition to God's people. I mean, Balak's trying to destroy them. Going to destroy them. Okay, Edom sets his face against God, going to destroy them. But the whole point in verse 17 is, I see him. But not now. Well, when? Do you see that? I see the Messiah, but not now. Well, then when? Well, how about after the destruction of the Amalekites, after the destruction of the Kenites, after the destruction of the Assyrian Empire? Look at this. So in verse 24, the ships come from the west. That's how we get that from Kittim. Okay, and they're heading east to Asher and Eber. Now, here's how the end of verse 20, this Hebrew thing is just throwing me. I've been telling you this every week. I looked up, so they also is one word. And they're trying to decide if this is singular or plural. So I pull it up on this Hebrew website that I have my concordance through, and I can see the Hebrew word, and I hover my mouse cursor over it. And the literal definition of this word is a singular masculine noun. Okay, so the NASB says they. Well, who's going to come to destruction? Okay, are you guys in the end of verse 24 there? You see that? Ships come from Kittim, and they're going to afflict East, Asher, and Eber. So they also will come to destruction. It is actually probably better if it said, and he will also come to a destruction. Who destroyed Alexander the Great? What nation came after Alexander the Great's conquering nation? Rome. Insert the Messiah. You see that? If they let this come through like the literal Hebrew should be, they will afflict Asher and will afflict Kittim. The ships that come from Kittim will afflict Asher and Eber. Now, to fall, they have a hard time, so he will also come to destruction, but his kingdom falls. Yes? Alexander the Great's kingdom falls, and Rome rises in its place. And it's in the days of Rome the Messiah comes. So it takes us, and there's a lot of history, takes us a lot of definitions, but once we finish, what are we walking away with? Verse 17, I see him, but not now. When? When he comes to a destruction. When his nation is overthrown. The nation of Greece is overthrown. Bam, Rome, insert the Messiah. So not only do we have a prophecy of the star that comes from Jacob, Jesus, the scepter will be with him, and it will rise from Israel. Okay, verse 19, he will have dominion, destroy the remnant of the undefiant. Like there's no scattering people left in the city. Like everyone meets judgment. Okay, and when does he come? Bang, bang, bang. We have this timeline. Verse 17, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. And then the whole rest of this discourse is like this timeline of what is going to take place. And so when we cover our definitions, because it's like Cain, you know, K-A-I-N, like who's that? You know, the Kenite, we have to remind ourselves, who are these people from? Is Asher a reference to Assyria? Things like that. When we go through and work out our definitions, we see this nation gets conquered, and it's by them. And then when that nation comes from Kittim and goes east, and then it falls, him, the one that Balaam saw in the vision. So that's Numbers 24. We're a couple minutes over. We can do an abbreviated prayer requests and thanksgiving. I do want to give us 30 seconds here for any closing comments. Jared has one, and then we'll wrap up.
So I just want to be clear. I understood what you were saying. So you're saying the hymn in verse 17 is a reference to Alexander the Great,
the Messiah. So verse 17, I see him, the star that comes from Jacob.
That's what I thought. But I thought you would step the other way around. That's why I wanted to clarify.
Yeah. So, you know, so when we get through like 45 minutes of Kittim and Esau and Red, and what did we do? Why did we do that? Because Balaam says, I see him. The star that comes from Jacob. The scepter, the one who has dominion and rule from Israel. He will increase and his adversaries will decrease. And all I'm saying is, hey, you, when you actually do the research to find out who these nations are and what order they get destroyed in, you also see when he comes. Because that's what Balaam said. Not only does he see him, but he said, not now. So I just kept saying to myself, well, when? How about when Asher is gone and Eber is gone and the nation that destroyed them is even gone? That only leaves us with Rome. So, yeah. Thankful for the clarification. Okay, 5 minutes over. Do you want to get us out of here at a good time? So we'll do abbreviated prayer session here.